Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn five times the national average. Banking with Capital One means five times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or five times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even five times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One and a member FDIC.
Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Luke Jones. In the early hours of Friday, the 20th of December, these are our main stories. The bitter divisions again on show in US politics as Republican and Democrats argue over the impeachment of President Trump. Russia's security agency says one of its officers is being killed by a gunman who opened fire outside its headquarters in Moscow. And the concept of love.
There is no universal concept of love. The way that Europeans think about love might differ from the way that people in South America think about love.
How the meaning of emotions differ around the world. Also on this podcast, researchers unravel another mystery of the cosmos, how supermassive black holes formed when the universe was very young.
We are pushing our knowledge of the universe to the really close to the Big Bang. Really close, I mean, in astronomical time, so it's 1 billion years after the Big Bang.
And the nomination of Hassan Diab as the new Prime Minister of Lebanon fails to end weeks of anti-government protests. Let's start with Donald Trump. The US president is the third to be impeached in more than 200 years. Eyes now turn to the Senate, the upper chamber in the US Congress, where a trial will be held. Mitch McConnell is the leader of the Republicans in the Senate. He says the process has been the most rushed, least thorough, and most unfair in history. There is no substance to the allegations against the president, he said on Thursday.
This is by far the thinnest basis for any House-passed presidential impeachment in American history. The thinnest and the weakest, and nothing else even comes close.
The leader of the Democrats in the House of Representatives, the lower chamber, is Nancy Pelosi. With regards to what happens now, she wants more clarity on the procedure.
Well, we'd like to see a fair process, but we'll see what they have and we'll be ready for whatever it is. We would hope there would be a fair process, just as we hope that they would honor the Constitution. By the way, I heard some of what Mitch McConnell said today, and it reminded me that our founders, and when they wrote the Constitution, they suspected that there could be a rogue president. I don't think they suspected that we could have a rogue president and a rogue leader in the Senate at the same time.
So, very much a partisan argument still. Our Washington correspondent is Gary O'Donoghue.
Absolutely. I don't think that's going to change any time soon, quite frankly. Nancy Pelosi has this one power still in her gift, which is to withhold passing these articles of impeachment to the Senate until she thinks the rules governing the trial are to her liking or to the Democrats' liking. But she also has the clock ticking in her own respect, in her own party's respect, in that really Democrats would have very mixed views, I think, about this Senate trial dragging on beyond January, because, of course, their primary for their presidential candidate begins at the beginning of February with the Iowa caucus. And so there are some key balances to be done here. But at the moment, there's a standoff on the rules of governing the trial.
And in terms of those rules, what would Nancy Pelosi, what would the Democrats like to see, and what would the Republicans like to see?
Democrats want to see more witnesses called to give evidence during the trial. The Republicans want something that's pretty straight up and down, lawyers arguing a bit on each side, and then a vote of the 100 senators. So get it over as quickly as possible. That is still the position. Mitch McConnell, the leader, the Republican leader in the Senate, has made it clear that he doesn't plan to let this go on any longer than he needs to. And he also has made it pretty clear that he's not interested in hearing anything that might change his mind. I think that's probably true on both sides, but he's actually said it out loud and said that he doesn't plan to be impartial.
So what can we expect then from the trial in the Senate? Is it going to be some big television spectacular with lots of drama?
Look, it is a spectacle, there's no question about it. I mean, it will only be the third time in 240 years of this republic that a president has been tried in the Senate. You know, simple as that, on that basis. But the outcome is utterly predictable. It will last probably a week or two, and it will be over, and the president will be acquitted. That's how things look at the moment. Now, never say never. Things can change. Of course they can. But there's no real reason at this stage to believe that narrative is going to change.
Gary O'Donoghue reporting from Washington. As we've been hearing, the impeachment process has exposed America's deep partisan divides. Polls show that the support for the president is split along party lines and remains unchanged. So what are the implications for the 2020 presidential election? Jane O'Brien reports from New Hampshire, which Donald Trump lost by less than 0.5% in 2016, and his campaign believes he could win next year.
This is the day people in the White Mountains have been waiting for, and no, it has nothing to do with impeaching the president. One of the first snowfalls of the season has brought skiers to the resorts, and the chairlifts are running.
Well, obviously, we're a lot more excited about the snow today than we are about the impeachment, or we'd be sitting home in front of our television sets today, which we are not. We're out here having a good time.
Shouldn't be about what our president's doing. I think he's doing a good job, honestly.
I'd rather be skiing than watching the hearings anyways, but it's all going to amount to nothing. Total waste of time. He did nothing wrong. And the snow's a lot more fun. Have the vote today, get over, and tomorrow in the Senate, they can find him not guilty and move on.
Waste was the word in one survey that 10% of Americans associated with impeachment. Polls show that interest has steadily declined and few minds have been changed, even in this part of New Hampshire where people treat politics as seriously as the weather. Mark Garang is the publisher of the Conway Daily Sun.
The partisans are very partisan, and they've already decided one way or the other. And that middle, whatever it is, 20-30%, is undecided and probably a little disinterested. And it's probably not unlike the Clinton impeachment, where until something really riveting happens, that they won't become interested.
Impeachment in itself is no longer riveting.
Unfortunately, that's the case. It seems like it's being used as a political weapon. I mean, what seems striking about this one compared to Clinton, that's a little disturbing, I think, for all of us here, is that nobody can really agree on the facts. At least with Clinton, at some point we all knew what he did, and even President Clinton admitted and apologized. But in this case, we're operating in two different universes of facts.
Our founding fathers must be rolling in their graves right now. What the Democrats are doing is really frightening for the future of our country.
Sue Nelson is a Republican and a staunch supporter of President Trump.
They are trying to impeach a president who has broken no laws on the grounds that they don't agree with his policies and they hate him. And America, you need to wake up to this. This is very scary.
Sue Nelson is convinced that impeachment will galvanize voters of both parties to support the president in 2020. Democrats like Karen Davenport are just as convinced they won't.
I think it's got to turn some voters. The Republican Party has shrunk. So 50% or whatever percentage rate he has of approval.
91.
But it's of a smaller number. And I don't know if I agree with polls. We thought Hillary was going to win and we were going to have a Democratic Congress.
Does it matter that he probably won't be impeached in the Senate?
Yeah, it does. He's still there and he's still dangerous.
With more snow forecast, the ploughs are already out and about in the White Mountains. As the ski season and the election season gather momentum, keeping the roads open is a round-the-clock job. But the path for the president is less clear, as impeachment now moves from the House of Representatives to a full trial in the Senate.
Jane O'Brien reporting from New Hampshire. This was the scene outside the Lubyanka building in Moscow. The building is the headquarters of Russia's intelligence agency, the FSB. Several people were killed or wounded in the shooting, which came just hours after President Vladimir Putin's annual press conference. My colleague Tim Franks spoke to Sergei Goryashka from the BBC Russian service in Moscow.
It happened just hours after the President Vladimir Putin has finished his annual press conference with journalists. And at first we didn't know much details because our media were reported about three gunmen who tried to enter the reception room at the FSB headquarters, shot the guards, then two of them were shot, and then one of them tried to hide and shoot other policemen, and during the special operation, he was killed. After the FSB has reported that the gunman is killed, they've suddenly told that there was only one shooter, only one gunman, and his victim was one FSB officer. Another policeman was badly injured, but he's alive and he's stable now, as the doctors are telling us. And we don't know much about the motive or about who the gunman was, but FSB services has already told that they will classify this action as a terrorist attack.
And the gunman himself has been killed, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. Oh, we've got actually a very hard footage. I've seen a graphic footage on the one of the Russian media outlets, and it can be seen just a person in black clothes. He's holding an AK-47, and he's shooting the policeman, some people from the special ops who were trying to kill him, and he was killed.
Right, and this area of Moscow, where the Lubyanka is, where the FSB headquarters are, is that still under lockdown as far as we know?
About a half an hour ago, it was still in the lockdown, so there were people from the police and from the FSB and from the investigative committee working there. I think they were gathering remains of the bullets, and they were figuring out whether he had an explosive vest or something like grenades or other explosives. And there were some information that he actually did have grenades, but it wasn't confirmed. And the area is still in lockdown.
Sergei Goryashka from BBC Russian. The Lebanese president, Michel Aoun, has designated Hassan Diab as the new prime minister as anti-government protests continue on the street. Our Arab Affairs analyst Sebastian Usher reports.
The new Lebanese Prime Minister Hassan Diab is a little-known academic, which could potentially play to his advantage, as a key demand of the anti-government demonstrations has been to clear away the existing political system. But he faces a huge task, first in simply forming a government and then trying to redress Lebanon's dangerously failing economy. He won't find it easy to win the confidence of the protesters, while his nomination has already split the main political factions. He's backed by Hezbollah, but there are suggestions but Sunni parties may not serve in his government.
Sebastian Usher reporting. Scientists have uncovered the world's oldest forest. It dates back 386 million years and throws new light on the evolution of trees and their role in shaping the world. More now from Terry Egan.
The remains of the forest were discovered in an abandoned quarry in the Hudson Valley in New York. Because of the many fish fossils also seen there, the scientists think it was wiped out by a flood. What's left, though, are the fossilised remains of an extensive network of trees, which would have spread from New York all the way into Pennsylvania and beyond. By examining the ecology and habits of such forests, the scientists hope they'll understand how trees began to draw carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and how the Earth became a forested planet.
Terry Egan with that report. Still to come on the podcast, how to manage your digital afterlife.
If Facebook continues to grow at their current pace, they will accumulate hundreds of millions of dead profiles in the next few decades. It's basically the biggest archive of human behavior ever assembled in the history of our species.
And why it matters. Now, France has deployed its first armed drones to fight jihadists in Africa's Sahel region. They'll be mainly used for intelligence gathering, but will also be used to launch airstrikes. Mary Harper reports.
The three American-built Reaper drones are fitted with large laser-guided missiles. The French Defence Minister, Florence Parly, said they'll mainly be used for intelligence missions, but will also be able to strike targets. Earlier this week, the French Chief of Staff issued a stark warning. Either governments in the Sahel get their act together, or the Islamic State group will take hold. A significant presence of foreign and local forces, including 4,500 French troops, have been unable to defeat the militants. Last week, more than 70 soldiers from Niger were killed.
The self-ruled island of Taiwan, off the southeast coast of China, is about to elect a new president and legislature. The island's incumbent president, Tsai Ing-wen, is riding high in the polls, in part because of what's going on in Hong Kong. President Tsai supports full independence for Taiwan from China. China's President Xi Jinping is insisting Taiwan must unify with China under the same one-country, two-systems model used for Hong Kong. But since the huge pro-democracy protests broke out in Hong Kong, public opinion has swung behind President Tsai and her refusal to concede to Beijing. Our Asia correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes reports from the outlying islands of Jinmen, controlled by Taiwan, but just 2 kilometres off the coast of communist China.
The last time I came here to Jinmen, at least 20 years ago, you couldn't walk along this beach because it was still heavily mined. Today, the tourists from China and Vietnam and elsewhere are happily out on the beach taking selfies. And in the distance, just 2 or 3 kilometres away, the tall, gleaming glass towers of the city of Xiamen on the Chinese coast.
At a nearby wharf, a ferry is pulling in. One arrives from Xiamen every half hour. For decades, China pounded Jinmen with hundreds of thousands of shells. Now the island is almost entirely dependent on tourists getting off these ferries. One place they all love to head to is the workshop of Wu Zhengdong. This master knife maker uses the shell casings from old Chinese shells, heating and hammering them, turning them into exquisite handcrafted kitchen knives, which he then sells back to the Chinese tourists. For the last 20 years, Master Wu's business has grown and grown, but now his best customers have suddenly stopped coming.
Recently, relations between China and Taiwan have got much worse, and the numbers of Chinese tourists has dropped dramatically, by around 70%.
Jinmen is back on the front line of what some are now describing as a new Cold War.
Back in 1958, America and China nearly went to war over these islands. Since then, there has been an uneasy peace, maintained in large part by America's overwhelming might and China's weakness. But today, China is no longer weak. And under President Trump, US commitment to defend Taiwan and these outlying islands along the China coast is at best uncertain.
This is the sound of President Xi Jinping reviewing his troops on Tiananmen Square in Beijing on October the 1st. On display, many of China's newest missiles, designed to sink US aircraft carriers. America's own computer simulations show it could now lose a war against China in the Taiwan Straits. President Xi Jinping is both more hardline and more impatient than his predecessors to see Taiwan unified, to follow Hong Kong and Macau, to complete the project to bring all Chinese territories under Beijing's rule. At the old Foreign Ministry building in Taipei, built when Chiang Kai-shek still ruled here, I meet current Foreign Minister Joseph Wu.
After the violence and protest activities in Hong Kong in the last 3 months, the public opinion surveys suggested that close to 90% of the Taiwanese people would reject one country, two system model. So it's very clear the people in Taiwan see what's happened in Hong Kong, and we don't want to accept one country, two system model.
At a market in downtown Taipei, Xie Pei Fun is out canvassing for votes. It's election season in Taiwan. Next month, its people will elect a new president and legislature. Ms. Xie is hoping to win a seat. It is this that sets Taiwan apart from China. It is why Xie Pei Fun says the democratic world must stand with this island democracy.
We identify ourselves as Taiwanese, as a people from a free and democratic country. And that's why China's attempt to unify Taiwan or to force unify Taiwan will not succeed.
Rupert Wingfield Hayes reporting. Now, you've probably heard of black holes in space, but what about supermassive black holes? They're called quasars. They're some of the oldest and brightest objects in the universe, a billion times greater in mass than the Sun. And now scientists have discovered the perfect feeding grounds for supermassive black holes, finally cracking how these holes actually grew so big and so fast. Emanuela Paolo Farina of the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics in Germany is the lead researcher.
We are now with the most advanced telescope that are now on Earth. We are pushing our knowledge of the universe to this really close to the Big Bang. For really close, I mean in astronomical time, so it's 1 billion years after the Big Bang. And the life of the universe is around 13.7, something like that, billion years. So it's like when you are like 8 years old in human life or something like that. But we see that these objects are already as massive as 1 billion solar masses already at this time.
And why is that strange? Why do you expect not to see that?
Because as long as someone introduces you like their baby, you don't expect a 2 meters tall person. So it's like there is actually not enough time to arrive to that mass. And this is strange because we don't expect that. Let's put it that way. You don't expect that a black hole can grow that fast in that short time.
And so what do we now know about how these black holes grew to be so supermassive so quickly?
So actually, one of the questions is like, if you see something that grows that fast, you have to have a lot of food around. So you have to have something that is available for it to grow. But now we see that actually there is a lot of gas around. So there is actually enough food to fuel the growth of the black hole. So we are basically checking the fridge of this black hole.
This might sound like a thick question, but what actually do you see when you're looking at this? What does it look like?
So when you look like to a quasar at this redshift, it looks like a dot. So there is like not much more information that you can derive from that. It's actually like just a little dot. But when you select a specific region of the wavelength of the electromagnetic spectrum where you expect to see the emission of the gas, they actually you see a big fuzz around that. So it's like a glowing fuzz, a glowing clouds around this dot that is the supermassive black hole. So what we are looking for was actually this glow around the quasars.
Emanuela Paolo Farina of the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics. Now, what happens to someone's online identity, to their social media profiles when they die? It's estimated by the end of the century, Facebook will have accumulated billions of profiles of dead people. But who owns that digital afterlife and who manages it? They're questions that internet companies are just starting to deal with, as the BBC's Manuela Saragossa has been finding out.
When someone dies, there are coroners, cemeteries and funeral directors at hand to help organise things. Not so in the digital world, because sure, your spirit may endure, but so do your social media accounts. And that raises all sorts of problems that the internet world is only just starting to deal with. Let's start with the story of Adam Parker and his boyfriend Dean here in the UK. They met over social media.
Dean and I actually met via Twitter. And I remember him tweeting a picture of his cat. And so I direct messaged Dean and said, oh my gosh, your cat is so cute. And then from there, we really got along and hit it off. And then we met in person and we had a really great time together.
But Dean died in 2017. He'd been battling cancer. He was only 21. The Twitter feeds and Instagram photos Dean had left behind became an important part of Adam's grieving process.
One of the things I did was go through all of the photos that Dean had posted on Instagram and screenshot ones that I thought were particularly meaningful for me. But obviously, like with Twitter, there's like all the textual data. There's also the photo data. There's the way that he interacted with people that are also important information that I want.
And then last month, Twitter said it would close down accounts that had been inactive for at least 6 months. That would have included Dean's account.
For me, it kind of feels like Twitter could potentially delete a large proportion of the way in which my partner constituted a lot of his life, which is hurtful.
That was Adam Parker speaking to the BBC. There was an outcry at Twitter's plans to delete inactive accounts precisely because of stories like Dean and Adam's. Twitter put the plans on hold, but stories like theirs highlight a growing problem. what to do with the rising number of ghost accounts on social media platforms. It's a question Carl Oman has been studying. He's a PhD candidate at the Oxford Internet Institute here in the UK.
Basically, everything that we do online leaves some kind of trace behind, that maybe search data or social media data. And what happens when we die is that all of that data stays there.
I was just looking through my own Facebook friend list.
Mm-hmm.
There are four people on there who have died since I joined Facebook just under a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
Their profiles are still there. It's active. People do still post there, particularly on their anniversary of their death or on their birthdays. But who owns that page? Who owns that data?
It's actually a quite complicated legal question that I don't think that we've completely figured out yet. Whilst you're alive, the company and you own that data together. But of course, when the one party disappears, then Facebook is the sole owner of the data. Now, that being said, you might actually have uploaded material that is or can be copyrighted. And there is an ongoing debate in the legal community as to whether that data can actually be inherited.
In the same way that if you die and you leave letters that are addressed to people, or perhaps you leave a diary, shouldn't it be treated in that way?
I think that's a reasonable point to be made. But one thing that we should really keep in mind here is that the kind of data that we leave behind online is much more than just a diary where we write certain notes. Much of the data that we leave behind online is actually data that we never expect anyone to read. Things that you've clicked on, things that you've liked, different behavioral patterns of like what you're searching for and so forth.
Eventually, these social media sites like Facebook, like Twitter, are going to have tens of millions of people on there who are no longer alive.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do with that data? And I imagine this is something that's just going to snowball.
Very much so. So a study that we published in April looks at this from a sort of population demographic perspective. If Facebook continues to grow at their current pace, they will accumulate hundreds of millions of dead profiles in the next few decades. And towards the end of the century, there will be about 5 billion. So it's a gigantic archive of data. I mean, it's basically the biggest archive of human behavior ever assembled in the history of our species.
Carl Oman at the Oxford Internet Institute, ending that report by Manuela Saragossa. Now, dictionaries suggest that the English word love can be equated with the Turkish word sevgi and the Hungarian word serelem. But does this mean that the concept of love is the same in Britain, Turkey and Hungary? According to a study of nearly 2,500 languages by researchers in the US and Germany, the meaning of emotions actually differs around the world, as Oliver Conway reports.
Contrary to older theories, this study suggests that humans do not experience the same set of finite emotions. Rather, our feelings vary according to our culture and language. The researchers analysed words with more than one definition, such as funny, meaning both amusing and peculiar in English. Comparing language groups around the world, they found significant differences in the way emotions were seen.
There is no universal concept of love. The way that Europeans think about love might differ from the way that people in South America think about love might differ from the way that people in the Pacific Islands think about love.
Lead author Joshua Conrad Jackson says in the Pacific Islands, love is seen as being more similar to pity, rather than the Western concept of liking or happiness. And although all humans distinguish emotions in the same way at a basic level, whether they are pleasant or unpleasant, for example, we have evolved to experience them differently.
So right now you might be feeling positive or negative. Your heart might be beating at a certain level, and that's universal. But as soon as you begin thinking about how you're feeling, and when you give a label to how you're feeling, that label is steeped in the culture that you've grown up in. And so even if those feelings of your heart starting to beat faster because you see something dangerous, even if that feeling is universal, the way that you ascribe meaning to that, and even the way that you think about it in your own head, varies a lot across cultures.
Other examples in the study included anxiety being related to anger in Europe and the Middle East, but regret or grief in Southeast Asia. While in the Caucasus, anger is close to envy, but it means hate, bad or proud in the Pacific.
Oliver Conway reporting. And that's all from us for now. There'll be an updated version of this Global News podcast a little bit later on. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email anytime, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Luke Jones. Until next time, goodbye.
Capital One has a fresh take on banking. Now you can open a new savings account in about 5 minutes and earn 5 times the national average. Banking with Capital One means 5 times the savings towards your dream honeymoon, or 5 times the savings towards your family's ultimate vacation. Even 5 times the savings towards just feeling good about saving. It's time to make your savings goals come true. This is Banking Reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One, N.A. member FDIC.